Still think that's God's masterpiece, that particular intro. I'd happily buy a whole album of that music if God made
it. Oh, it's beautiful work. Beautiful work.
Brilliant. Brilliant work. Well, this week, there's no Morgoth. He has got a medical trip, I think it was, or something. So he can't make it today, unfortunately, for the second half of Adam Curtis's The Trap Part 2. We were unceremoniously cut off last week. Mm. And apparently that was a StreamYard's wide problem, Simon. Apparently lots of people had that problem on that day. So obviously...
It wasn't Spice levels becoming too critical in the discussion of genetic heritability.
I suspect perhaps with the election foray... maybe StreamYard bandwidth had hit its limit around the world, or assuming they use some sort of fancy cloud technology where the data just shifts across, you know, and opens up as and when they need it, which they probably do. Maybe they were just doing like a routine upgrade or something. I don't know, or routine maintenance work or whatever. But
well, the Chinese were doing routine underwater cable cutting or something like that, you know.
In Sweden, apparently. Would you like, before we start, I am doing my sale at the moment. Yeah. How much of the Chinese water torture shall I give people?
I think the full merit. I think it needs to... Repetition is an important part of education, as you will know.
Repeat it every day.
Absolutely. And you can't have enough of this.
25% off all courses. Promo code MERIT.
Merit. Pure merit. Such merit. 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 Merit. Such merit.
Merit.
Merit. Merit. Such merit. Merit.
Merit.
Such merit. Merit. Such merit. Merit. Such merit. Merit. Such merit. Merit. Such merit.
Oh, I don't know. Of all the ads, I think that may have, over time, may have become... Because it's the most kind of... aggressively antisocial one.
Although the lasers coming out of his eyes, can't you?
There was this one though. Do you remember?
Oh,
mate.
Do you remember that one?
I do.
But anyway, no merit. I've got an update on what many people are now calling Currygate, Simon, or Curry's Gate, I should say.
Yes.
So do you remember last week I had a call from, the guy who originally served me? That was all the way back in October the 17th when I put in my old laptop for a 7-day repair. Okay. Last Monday was when? The 11th of November, okay? He called me and said, your laptop's been written off. And so therefore, we're going to issue a voucher. Mm-hmm. So the following day, as I recounted on the show, I went in to Curry's and requested, I was like, okay, this guy said there was going to be a laptop. Oh, yeah, it comes within 24 hours. I said, well, he said it 27 hours ago. So, and then they said, oh, yeah, it comes within 3 days. Okay, well, 3 days came and 3 days went. And I waited all the way until Sunday. So that was the 17th of November. And I phoned Curry's complaints department, recounting the whole tawdry tale, Simon, from start to finish, including the rudeness I encountered, the lack of apologies, and so on and so forth. Well, they said, oh, well, the thing is, we've lost your laptop. I was like, yeah, okay. But last Monday, the guy rang me and said, your laptop's being written off and you'll have a voucher. Mm. Oh, yeah, but the thing is, we've lost it. Mm. Okay, and I said, right. He said it was being written off. So whether it's lost or not, it's for the birds, mate. I said, what are you doing with this voucher? Are you sending it on, you know, with a bloke on the back of a horse? Are you sending it by carrier pigeon?
Man, with
how long does it take to send one email with a voucher attached to it? Hmm. Oh, well, the thing is, because we found out it's lost now, it's going to take another, like, you'll have it within 3 days. It takes 3 days to issue it. And because today is Sunday, you know, we'll have to do it tomorrow or the next day. So you'll have it within 48 hours. Well, it's Wednesday today, Simon. Do I have a voucher?
I think they sent it on an underwater cable from Sweden.
I don't have a voucher, Simon, okay? And also, the guy promised me I would get a call from the complaints department from Curry's to try to reach a resolution.
Yeah.
Whereupon, I expect them to say, sorry for this, here's a 50% off anything you want, sir.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
Well, we fucked you around for the past month.
That would be excellent service.
Did I get that? No.
Not really. No.
Absolutely no hint of any sort of urgency from Curry's. I'm actually wondering how long they can take. I mean, on their thing, when you go up on the counter, it's literally got in blazing letters, our 7-day guarantee. Right? The original voucher was issued because they had undoubtedly failed their 7-day guarantee. Yeah. Then their issuance of the voucher was delayed because they lost my original laptop.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you work out this logic. But anyway, all I'll say is that Curry's is the worst. I mean, they must be the worst company in the entire country.
I said to you the other day, I thought this was going to end up like you with you being like Joseph K. in Kafka's The Trial, you know, going on to some sort of dystopian bureaucratic nightmare loop where eventually you're actually found guilty of losing your own laptop in some way. But it's developing echoes of the sort of Monty Python cheese shop sketch as well, you know, where they sort of pretend something's happening and finally have to admit that nothing is happening.
Oh, it's just and the guy on the phone, well the first thing, let me just say, the first thing, sir, we're sorry. All right, yeah. Hey, thanks. There's my fucking apology. How about you give me my voucher? Anyway.
Yes. You know.
Yes. Anyway, enough of that. Anyway, I wonder what sort of managerial targets that Curry's have.
I think maybe
if Curry's employed a single person of European heritage, they may actually, like, I don't know how anything functions in that company.
Well, we're going to see a case study in that in this section of the trap, you know. But the thing I've been reflecting on recently, a lot of your stuff about value-free analysis and objectivity, you know, it sort of ties into this sort of overall theme of the trap, of this desire to kind of make these projective forms of governance where you can, you know, as Curtis keeps saying, you know, relying on the objective power of numbers. And this way that we have this political class trying not to respond to reality and, if you like, react in a realistic way to it, but to try and create this pre-formatted world. And what we, you know, saw, for instance, in the wake of the Trump election the other week, you know, we had, you know, we had Rory Stewart, you know, giving his an analysis about how, you know, well, he got it wrong based on sort of optimism and technical reasons, you know, as to why Kamala should have won, you know. But it's funny because, I mean, when I did my little Morgoth hype intro in the style of Stuart Lee the other time, I was watching, rewatching one of his old acts, called his old shows called Tornado. And it's not one of his best shows, I would say. It's reasonably amusing. It's it's the one where he makes a joke about sharks on the stage. It's difficult to explain at the end, but he says something very key in it, and he's doing the sort of Stuart Lee thing of being somewhat self-deprecating and also pulling back the curtain to sort of show how he structures his comedy at the same time. And he says something very key in it, which I think is a ringing theme for all of this. And he says, you know, oh, I just write what I think and then wait for reality to align with it, which seems to be a profoundly, you know, a prescient statement when it comes to all of this stuff. These people are just waiting for reality to align with what they think.
I reckon Stuart Lee could probably get an hour and a half out of my Curry's Adventure.
Easily.
Because, you know, like how he structures his shows, he's usually telling like a very banal story.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. But he just kind of keeps on hitting tangents or side rants or whatever. So it takes him about 90 minutes to you know, finish it, the story. And it's like, oh, I went shopping or something, you know?
Yeah.
He could easily get a lot of mileage out of that. But anyway, one of the things I've been thinking about when it comes to our subject matter here is that there's an extent to which if it's not data, it doesn't exist in, like, for our government, you know. If you don't exist bureaucratically, you don't exist at all, coming back to the trial and Kafka and so on. And I've often wondered whether that could, you know, also be their weakness, that, you know, if they could, like, there are people who are just invisible to the system because they can't see them because there's no data point. And I've thought about this quite a bit because obviously these days we're all online and we're constantly chatting online and everybody's on X and so on, or Twitter, I think that's the first time I've ever called it X, but everybody's on Twitter and everybody's talking, or here we are doing this show. And it strikes me that every time you do that, you create a data point, you create information for them, right? And this is actually one of the reasons why a lot of people left Twitter the last week and went to that Blue Sky thing. It is because they changed the terms of service on Grok. In fact, they changed the terms of service in two ways. One, they've made it so that you can only see Twitter in Texas. So that's why The Guardian left, right?
Yeah.
But the second thing is that they've sneakily changed it so that by default, if you're on Twitter, Grok can use all of the data from your account for its algo, for its information. Which then made me think, oh, well, basically what you are on Twitter is building up kind of mental picture for this AI program, Grok. And I don't know how I feel about that, really. So, yeah, anyway, that's something to think about as we press play here. So when we left off, we were having a really interesting conversation with Morgoth about anthropology and evolutionary biology, weren't we? But I cannot remember what we were saying.
He's gone through a lot of Dawkins material, actually. He's very, very well read on this.
Yes. In fact, that was it. We were talking about Dawkins, and it was just starting to get really interesting. And then StreamYard went down. Well, we're not going to be able to recapture that. So this is the difficult second album, as it were.
Simon. There we go. Oh, nice. I see what you did there.
Always the in jokes.
Yeah.
Names and relationships. He also gave out Western goods, above all the prize machete, in return for information, until he had built up what he believed was an accurate database of the names and genealogies of 6,000 Yanomami.
Oh, yeah, I remember. So we were a little bit ahead of here. We might as well watch. So this was where they were tricking this guy.
I wonder if we've had a subtle invasion of anthropologists handing out machetes in South London and places like well, in exchange for ethnographic information.
That's one way of putting it.
Which he then stored on a computer at his university. Chagnon then returned with a film crew and recorded in great detail a fight in a village.
Bring your camera over here.
Chagnon returned to America and went through the film frame by frame, identifying all the participants. On the surface, there seemed no meaning to the fight. Often individuals who appeared closely related attacked each other. But when Chagnon fed their details into the computer and cross-checked them with his database, another reality emerged. Because of the Yanomami's complex history of intermarriage, individuals were related to each other in the most surprising ways. And what the computer showed was that the individuals who took risks for each other in the fight were always more closely genetically related than those they attacked.
My God, he's discovered genetic racism, Simon. He's discovered the secret source of all human morality.
Yeah. This is the problem we're going to encounter here, where Curtis, I think, is being a little bit rough and ready with Chagnon. Because when I first watched this documentary, I came away with a poor impression of him because of the framing, because of the sort of subtle edit codes that indicate Curtis is somewhat disparaging of his theory and the sort of counter witnesses that he brings on. But, you know, we'll see more about it as we go on, and we can talk about a little bit of the detail around his work.
There was a hidden pattern in the film, and it was the computer that proved and demonstrated that the pattern was there, because you can't possibly remember everybody's genealogical relatedness to everybody else in the village. So underneath all of this chaos and confusion and what meets the eye, there were people who shared genes with each other and chose sides on the basis of their relatedness to each other. Yeah, there's kind of a hidden mathematical dimension to the whole thing that you have to really dig for to discover.
Chagnon's experiment caused a sensation within the human sciences because it seemed to offer precise mathematical proof that genes played a powerful role in guiding human behaviour. It became one of the fundamental pieces of evidence underpinning a new, powerful model of human beings. They were machines whose actions and feelings were driven by coded instructions implanted deep inside them millions of years ago, of which they were unaware. It was an image that began to permeate deep into our culture.
The image of the organism, including ourselves, as a machine for passing on genes, to shift the focus away from the idea of the organism as being the agent in life to the immortal replicator.
Our DNA is a coded description of the worlds in which our ancestors survived.
DNA, it's the computer recipe for life itself. Unraveling like a reel of magnetic tape on some giant computer.
Back in the dark and frightening days of the Cold War, mathematicians had developed a simplified, machine-like model of human beings whose behaviour could be analysed and predicted by numbers. They had done this to try and understand and control the terrifying uncertainties of that time. Now in the 1990s, the Cold War was over and its giant defences lay empty. But that simplified model had risen up and triumphed as an explanation of what we truly are as human beings on every level, politically, economically, and now biologically.
We no longer see this theory as having historical inspiration in the Cold War. Instead, what we see it as a kind of quasi-natural social science theory of everything. It applies to something as small as a gene, or something as medium-sized as a human being, or something as large as a nation-state. The human being sort of dissolves in this social theory, that it isn't about necessarily human beings anymore.
You know, I'm slightly interested in here, Simon.
Mm.
Curtis doesn't think of looking back here.
Mm.
It's like, well, this is not the first set of people who've had biological explanations for human behavior. Mm. I mean, obviously, most famously, there was the mid-century Germans, of course, but even before them, you've got people like Galton or even Herbert Spencer, you know, who coined the phrase social Darwinism. But Curtis doesn't, he almost acts as if it was born here, just in the, as a symptom of the Cold War, and is not an idea that has actually reoccurred a number of times. Or if you want to take it in a less scientific direction, there is, of course, Oswald Spengler's ideas of the society being like an organism. Mm-hmm. And there is also Gobineau, of course, who had ideas that all political events really could be explained by what he called race. But what he meant by that was probably slightly different from what we understand it as being. For example, he believed that the French Revolution was an ethnic conflict, that the aristocrats and the people, you know, the bourgeoisie who led the revolution were actually of two different ethnic stocks. And it was kind of he explains everything in those terms. So I just find it interesting that Curtis almost acts as if Richard Dawkins here and friends are a ground zero during the Cold War.
You know? And Dawkins certainly echoes stuff that we actually saw back when we discussed the century of the self, in that sort of point in mid-century America where the federal agencies were interested in all this kind of experimentation with psychoactive drugs. There was very much a model that Dawkins literally quoted there of the magnetic tape. The magnetic tape had sort of risen just at the end of the First World War. And it's shot through all of the thinking on this, that it's seen as the human mind imprintable in that way and recordable and rewindable and programmable. So it does stay fixed within that sort of technological frame for a long time. And of course, the accusations about eugenics come along with Chagnon's colleague, James Neal, who went in with him in the late 60s. He's frequently kind of sort of smeared in the online literature.
I'm interested in how it switches, though, because those are one thing I would say about all of those earlier thinkers. And even if you want to go in a more edgy direction, you could think of like Madison Grant or somebody like that, right? Is they all talk in terms of an organism, a life form, right? Whereas these guys talk in terms of the robot or the machine or the computer. And I'm wondering what it is. I mean, maybe that is the bit that demarcates these people of the Cold War era from earlier biological thinkers, I guess.
I'm wondering if there's an even earlier conception as well. I mean, maybe this is very, very tenuous, but you know, you've often referred to the great chain of being in the sort of medieval period, and then you hit the Renaissance. And I've always remember, you know, the line in Hamlet, you know, when he's signing off that letter. And he signs it, "While this machine is to him, Hamlet." Mm. So maybe that Shakespeare was at some sort of pivot point where the conception of the human was being sort of radically altered.
Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Yeah. And in fact, that image, the ghost in the machine, is a chapter in The Blank Slate by Steven Pinker, who we talked about last time, I mean, without straying too far off, that gets into the whole notion of mind-body dualism. And in Shakespeare's time, and a little bit afterwards as well, if you read the metaphysical poets, it's in them a lot, is basically what they call mind-body dualism, that there is a disconnect between the mind and the body, almost like the body is a machine, right? That the mind can take flight from. You know, Andrew Marvell, who we did a stream on, has got a dialogue between, you know, the body and the soul, or the mind and the body, I can't remember what it is. Donne has got poems like that as well. So that was the concept at that, around that time. They did have this big disconnect between the kind of biological body and what we might think of as the mind, consciousness, soul. Yeah. You know,
you sort of had the legalistic frame as well, didn't you? I mean, the idea of the king's two bodies, you know, he would have the sort of body temporal and, you know, the body, as it were, regal, or the body politic of the king as the symbol, you know, so there was already a kind of sort of split and, thinking.
And the front piece of Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan actually tries to depict that, you know, where his body is made up of all the people of the nation.
Mm.
In that famous front image of the front cover, basically, of Hobbes's Leviathan. Very interesting. But of course, what Pinker was talking about, or what a lot of these guys think, interestingly, is that there is, like, that mind-body dualism is a mistake, and that actually the brain is part of the body and there's no distinction. The mind is not located somewhere else. So they have it, in a way, the mind comes back to the machine. So it's all machine, if you want. And this is really what we're talking about, because their conception of the brain, how it works, is very, very similar to computer, you know, RAM and ROM and long-term memory and et cetera. Anyway, let's play. Interesting tangent by us.
Very much.
It's about these little entities that are constantly questing to reproduce themselves and also find their maximum advantage.
And with the rise of this machine model of human beings, a new idea of how to change society began to emerge. Not through politics any longer, but by adjusting how well the individual machines functioned. The technicians of this new idea would be the psychiatrists and the drug companies who would free people from the terrible anxieties inside themselves.
Sorry to pause it again, Simon.
No.
Who's on the soundtrack here? Any ideas?
Oh, I think this is, I made a note somewhere. I think it's LCD Sound System. I think it's a song called Great Release. I could be wrong.
LCD Sound, that is such a Curtis pick. All right, let's carry on.
But what it would lead to would be a new form of order and control, not defined by the old political elites, but by the objective power of numbers.
I just found myself constantly worrying. I just couldn't stop.
My hands were shaking, and I was sure that people were looking at me and watching my hands.
These college students didn't know it then, but they were each experiencing the symptoms of an anxiety disorder. Panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, social phobia, and post-traumatic stress disorder.
This year, 23 million Americans will suffer from one of these anxiety disorders. They're the most common mental illness in the country, and they can attack anyone at any time.
In the early 90s, an epidemic of mental disorder was sweeping America and Britain. As last week's program showed, it had been uncovered by a new system for identifying disorders. Psychiatry had been attacked for relying on the personal and fallible judgment of psychiatrists. And instead, a new objective method based on checklists had been invented. These listed only the objective symptoms and deliberately did not inquire into why individuals felt an anxiety. In the late 80s, nationwide surveys had revealed an incredible picture. More than 50% of Americans suffered from mental disorders.
Did you see that one there, Simon? Stares blankly. do you reckon a young Keir Starmer filled that one out?
He'd love these surveys. I think, by the way, I'll take a rain check on that LCD sound system. I think I might have been looking at the wrong part of my notes there. It's another track. It's not that one. But nonetheless, I don't know if you remember this sort of period in the early to mid-90s, that there was this sort of hyper-focus on especially depressive illness and the whole thing of, I remember... You know, there's sort of one of the coffee table books that I would see in my sort of, you know, trendy London media friends that I would knock about with then was Prozac Nation by Elizabeth Wurtzel, which came out in 1994. Mm-hmm. And it was the start of this kind of, I call it sort of depression journalism, you know, and this was, I don't think the book did necessarily particularly well, but it was one of those ones that was, didn't necessarily sell, but was massively influential, and mm-hmm. the sort of beginning of confessional damage memoirs, you know, and this, yeah. this sort of became more extreme throughout the 90s when it got to people like John Diamond and Ruth Picardy, people who would like diagnosed with cancer and they'd write about facing their impending death. And so there was this really kind of black period of sort of, you know, going into the interior.
And it was very buried deep in the culture. I mean, obviously, I mean, most visibly, you've got like Kurt Cobain and Nirvana.
Lithium.
There. I've talked a lot about Daria. If you ever actually watch Daria, Daria is constantly psychoanalyzing people and explaining behavior that she sees in terms of the internal misery of, you know, like everybody around her. So like her parents are obviously like really unhappy or I mean, I can't remember the exact hit, but Daria does that a lot if you watch it. And I think Daria was out exactly in this moment. I think this was the time.
It was very much.
That was airing. So she, I mean, I really do believe that Daria is central to this particular Zeitgeist. Can you hear me, Simon?
Yeah. You just kind of break briefly for a second. Yeah, Daria.
All right. Let's play.
I'm just going to say one thing as well. Just before we go in, that Daria thing that persists mimetically even to this day on things like Twitter, because I think I've seen interactions maybe you've had in the last day or two, and people pull that kind of, you know, who hurt you kind of thing.
They do. Yeah.
To try and sort of break you down.
Yeah, they always get psycho. I mean, every once in a while, I stumble upon some obscure little stream where somebody's talking about me, right? You know, they may, and some of the shit people, like, they basically just invent a kind of mental picture of what motivates. Like, I saw this one stream as being like, oh, well, the thing is, like, this guy is bitter because, you know, he felt that the society owed him. I was like, what the fuck are you guys talking about? Like, what are you talking? I mean, what I'm saying is they invent psychoanalytical reasons for whatever you're doing, you know? I mean, it's just, I'll just say on that front, it's just not true. I mean, I kind of had my bells and whistles and accolades already, you know. I didn't need anybody to validate me. I was already kind of golden boy in my career. So I just don't know where that kind of, and then you'll find somebody else and they'll invent a whole different kind of mental headcanon. And this substitutes for actually engaging with anything anybody says, because you're now dealing with subtext rather than text. But
nearly always it's a projective reduction of you based on something that is usually troubling them quite deeply. You know, you can sort of pick up their own fixations through these particular accusations.
I've also noticed something else about the sorts of people who do that, but maybe that's for another stream. So let's
say
a pattern, you might say, but let's carry on.
Sad.
But at the very same time, the drug companies had announced that they had created a new type of drug called an SSRI, which they claimed targeted the circuits inside the brain that were causing these malfunctions. The SSRIs were marketed under names like Prozac. What they did was alter the amounts of serotonin that flowed across the circuit connections within the brain, and they readjusted the chemicals to normal levels.
And then all of a sudden, here comes somebody that says, okay, now try these on, try this Prozac on. And I tried it on, and for the first time in my life, I went, whoa, is this the way reality really is?
Pause. This pill can solve all of your problems. It's called Prozac.
That guy, was that guy with the beard, was he the model for Walter in The Big Lebowski? he does have that look.
Do you remember Kilroy? This is Kilroy, Robert, isn't it?
Yeah,
Robert Kilroy Silk.
Former, you know, doyen of UKIP.
And it may mean the end of depression as we know it.
I haven't taken Prozac for 2 years. And what difference has that made?
Brilliant.
Oh, she's smiling. Eyes lighter.
And I feel as if I'm back to normal.
You feel normal?
Yeah.
And you feel a better person?
Yeah. Yeah.
Through treatment, I learned to function with my disorder, and now life is so much more enjoyable.
Life is so much better now that I've gotten treatment, and I feel like I've got my OCD under control, and it feels really great.
A better life is waiting.
What now began to happen was that millions of people who had been diagnosed by the checklist as disordered went to psychiatrists to be medicated. The result was liberation from anxiety on a wide scale. But in the process, the checklist became a powerful and seemingly objective guide for people as to what should be their normal feelings and what was abnormal. And a number of leading psychiatrists began to argue that what they were actually doing was creating a static society in which human beings were adjusted by the medication so they fitted to an agreed normal type defined by the checklist.
People come to me all the time asking me to medicate them. The implication behind that was...
This never really ended, though, did it, Simon? We're still, in a way, living through this bizarre thing where you have checklist normality and everybody's trying to reach it. Giving you SSRIs,
selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. I'll do a little bit of confessional here. I mean, I've taken these things before in the past. I had a very difficult period of depression in the sort of mid-90s up until, I don't know, the sort of mid-2000s. And, you know, I have a very strong opinion on this stuff now. I'd say these things don't really help you, I'm afraid. They kind of take you into a bit of a netherworld where you've got a flattened emotional affect and you can sort of function. But it was very, very telling in those little clips of those people that, you know, you saw they're still kind of quite, and the woman in the Kilroy clip as well, they're still quite sort of either dead-eyed or they've got a slightly manic quality about them. And I think it's you know, a salutary thing to think that the sort of stuff that's being talked about in our spheres now about, you know, maybe adjusting lifestyle and you know, practicing perhaps more healthy, you know, exercise, nutrition, activity. I mean, I know there's a lot of stuff from the vitalism bros that, you know, people can sort of mock. But in a sense, a lot of the old boring advice about getting your life on track, especially as a young man, would benefit from pursuing those kind of strategies than the self-medicalization, you know, these kinds of undifferentiated cases of depression based on self-diagnostics. And of course, the internet, you know, accelerates and facilitates and makes this terrible. And we talked before about how the DSM manual had expanded exponentially. And I think a lot of it is really, you know, you see it in some of these shots. I mean, he's got a sort of shot of, you know, aerial shots of car parks and suburbia. And, you know, it's all of this, you know, individuated materiality on a sort of crushing scale that tends to drive us into this feeling of isolation and hopelessness and these parasocial relationships like we're having now online. But at least I think there's something more real in those things. And I think it certainly helps to think about, you know, getting away from the temptation to say, well, I'm going to, you know, take something for anxiety or, you know, take something for depression. Because, I mean, I've done the carousel of these things and ultimately they didn't help. What did help was pulling my finger out and stop being so self-pitying.
Mm.
Hate to put it like that, but it's...
I was given these SSRIs once because of my insomnia. And the doctor was like, oh... well, I think you may have anxiety. I was like, no, I just can't, you know.
Yeah.
I've had problems sleeping. You know, I don't have a proper circadian rhythm, you know.
Yes.
So anyway, they gave me these SSRIs. And I took them for a couple of days. And I felt it was like literally rearranging my brain. So I was like, fuck that. I'm not doing it. So I just didn't do it. I was just like, I went back to the doctor and said, I'm not doing that. So...
well, going into them, you get all sorts of very disorienting symptoms. You get something, I mean, I have something, you know, they call it the zaps, and it's like little sort of bolts of electrical charge, you know, kind of flashing across your, you know, your frontal lobes. And it takes a few days, and then you sort of settle into this, as I say, this kind of very flattened emotional state. I mean, the sorts of things you might have needed for sleep disorders, the problem is doctors tended to avoid prescribing them because of worries over people over sedating themselves. You know, mm-hmm. When I was given antidepressant medication initially, it was in the form of what they call tricyclic antidepressants, much older. And these were things like amitriptyline and prothioconazole and stuff like that. And of course, there was a worry about these because people had killed themselves by excess doses of them. I mean, famously, Nick Drake, the singer, had killed himself in the 70s by taking an overdose of triptazole. And so the drugs changed, and there was MOAIs, you know, monoamine oxidase inhibitors, things like that as well. And we settled into SSRIs. It's kind of, I find it frightening now, the numbers of people who are on them, you know, as it were, sort of casually as part of, you know, as part of their lifestyle, that, you know, they need this. And I think anxiety is possibly overdiagnosed as well, because I was given a sort of an anxiety sort of diagnosis and offered CBT and things like that. And certain forms of talking therapy may be helpful for people, but it didn't sort of get to the nub of the problem. A lot of it was, if you like, not having sort of foundational lessons in life that came from the world of, you know, cohesive families, you know, strongly differentiated gender roles, good fathering, things like that. And a lot of people lack that for various reasons. And you know, we're trying, I think, in this period to reconstruct ourselves. And, you know, it's very heartening to see a lot of, you know, the younger guys out there are attempting to do it by these, quote, you know, natural methods, and not get mired into this, as I say, this self-obsessed, medicalized state, which you can lose decades on if you're not careful.
Was that human beings, like all other animals, have a particular ideal model. It had a machine-like quality to it. We know what the model should be. And they asked the medications, they asked of me to give them medications that would push them back to this particular model they have, an unrealistic model, but a very static model of man as machine.
Has it worked? You look very dubious, my friend.
Apparently it has. I can't help being suspicious of it. I don't think she's the woman I married.
Why?
I think she's changed.
In what way?
I don't know, but there's something there that is different.
Okay, she's not the woman you married. Is she a better woman?
No, she's different.
They imagined that they might live in a world where they would...
I love the way they're talking about it, like she's a vegetable or something.
He's getting a bollocking later. You can sell from that expression.
I mean, they're just sitting talking about it.
Yeah.
So she's not there. Okay.
My wife's a vegetable.
Never be a worry, not even a grief, where never did conflict, concern, worry over alternatives make possible the kinds of progress that we've seen in the past.
But then, the man who had created the checklist system admitted that it might actually be leading millions of people to believe that they were disordered when they were not. The checklists added up only observable symptoms. They deliberately excluded any understanding of the patient's life. Because of this, he said, it confused genuine psychological disorder with normal human feelings of sadness and anxiety, and that this was happening on a wide scale. All this was being said by one of America's most powerful psychiatrists, Dr. Robert Spitzer.
What happened is that we made estimates of prevalence of mental disorders totally descriptively, without considering that many of these conditions might be normal reactions, which are not really disorders. That's the problem. Because we were not looking at the context in which those conditions...
Are they talking about, Simon, from my own understanding, you can just have like a normal sad? You're just feeling a bit sad today.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of depressive disorders are really rooted in sort of behavioral avoidance. And you will obviously, you know, feel the bitter fruits of life as you age, and, you know, you will have periods of feeling very sad, very lonely, isolated and bleak. But these are transient. They do pass. But the temptation to kind of prolong them into a sort of medicative state of dependency is what's being talked about here. And there were great incentives to do so at the time.
Developed.
So you have effectively medicalized much of ordinary human sadness, fear, ordinary experiences. You've medicalized them.
I think we have to some extent. How serious a problem it is not known. I don't know if it's 20%, 30%, I don't know. But that's a considerable amount if it is 20 or 30%.
What was happening was that large parts of normal human experience, grief, disappointment, loneliness, were all being reclassified as medical disorders. In the process, a new system of management was emerging. The drugs took away those complex and difficult feelings and made the individuals happier. But they also made them simpler beings, more easy to predict and manage, and closer to the machine-like creatures at the heart of the economic models.
By using checklists of symptoms about emotions, you have gone out and confused normal human responses to life with mental disorder and therefore created an illusion of a vast epidemic, a medicalized illusion. And obviously a situation where you medicalize is a situation where your focus will not be on social change. It will be on controlling individuals to fit in properly. That's the subtle and overall danger here, that it could serve our kind of social economic systems needs in a way in which we become more efficient, but less human.
What the psychiatrists had discovered was that an objective system based on numbers had led them into a trap. The numbers had imposed their own narrow logic on how we thought and felt about ourselves. And the politicians were about to find that their attempts to manage society by using numbers would also have the strangest consequences. Far from helping them achieve their progressive vision, they would actually make society more rigid and even harder to change. In 1997, New Labour was elected. What it promised was a society free of the arrogance and prejudices of the old elites who had dominated Britain's class system for so long.
It is us, the new radicals, a Labour Party modernised, that must undertake this historic mission. To liberate Britain from all the old class divisions, old structures, old prejudices, old ways of working and of doing things that will not do in this world of change.
Boo.
Boo.
gay, progressive young Tony. Oh. I want thoroughly evil, dark current tone.
Even at that stage, though, he's selling the vision of the inevitability of everything, you know, the changing world, the world in flux.
Yeah. But also the doing away with the old structures, don't I?
Yeah. Yeah. As a given. Yeah.
Throughout their campaign, New Labour had modelled themselves on the Clinton Democrats. And now in power, they did exactly what Clinton had done. They gave power away to the banks and the markets. Gordon Brown.
He just absolutely based Adam Curtis' analysis.
Yeah.
Straight to the heart of the map. Just like Clinton, they weren't radical at all. They just gave power to the banks.
That's it.
Base curse.
Brown's first announcement was to abandon the politician's final lever of control over the economy.
The new Chancellor, Gordon Brown, announces a revolution in economic policy. From now on, the Chancellor will hand control of interest rates to an independent Bank of England.
And in the management of society...
I mean, this is one of the things that drives me crazy about the managerial elite, right? And about... Yeah. About the Blairite system in particular. I mean, they do it everywhere. They do it in America too, but in this country. Oh, an independent body.
Mm.
And it's like Mark Carney.
Yeah,
Mark Carney's independent. Mark Carney, a man who has literally the identical views of Tony Blair in every single area, who meets with him at the WEF, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
This is independent. Independent. And they did this across like every single field. outsource it to an independent body that is literally just stuff with other versions of Tony Blair.
It's very much like performance and theatre. I mean, I remember what somebody said to me once. I was directing plays, and people often would say to me, you know, Simon, you're very good at casting, you know, getting the right people in the right positions for things. And then they would say, you know, yeah, that's kind of like 80% of doing a good production. But this period, it's interesting. I was watching, there's a documentary, an old BBC Two documentary called Blair and Brown that I was rewatching while we were leading up to this. And you sort of forget in a way the immense anxiety that Labour themselves were in the lead up to 97 because of the failures, especially the very spectacular failure of Kinnock in 92, you know, all right, you know, that anticipation of Labour coming back. Because again, like Stuart Lee said, they decided what they were going to think and they were just waiting for reality to adjust. But unfortunately, in Kinnock's case, reality wasn't adjusting to what Labour thought of themselves. And what you had was this nervousness of going wrong. And the documentary actually does show that quite well before Blair gets elected, that in a way, this idea of targets, and this will maybe come to it later, but this notion of targets and KPIs had been in existence throughout Britain at a local government level since the 80s. And some form of government efficiency management measurement had been around for around 100 years to some extent. But what you could see Labour thinking was that, you know, they're very conscious. I mean, you know, Blair is very conscious at this stage of having no experience. And Brown is very conscious of the obvious thing that happens when a Labour government's elected is a run on the pound and capital flight, you know. Mm. So in a sense, focusing on having automatic systems of governance is very appealing to them because you can sort of get the bureaucrats' heads down and get their attention being paid to other stuff, you know, while you're trying to sort of railroad through your change. And you've got to remember that actually, I forgot really, but when I looked back at this documentary, there were quite a few sort of issues they had to deal with very early on, from almost sort of hitting the ground running in 97. You had various crises. You had Peter Mandelson took out a loan from a guy he was meant to be investigating, Jeffrey Robinson, I think his name was.
Classic Andy, yep.
Yep. There was obviously Diana and the whole monarchy crisis, and there was the lead up to sort of finalizing the Good Friday Agreement. Mm-hmm. You know, so that period, sort of 98 to 2001, there was quite a lot of initial bruising that Blair was getting, and you sort of can somewhat forget about it in the sort of golden glow of the memory of Blair ascending to power. But he was kind of copying it from day one, and so this must have had quite a deal of appeal. This talk of, you know, liberation for these bureaucrats, but in the same way of keeping their heads down, keeping them busy and off your back while you're doing so for government.
Yeah, I mean, I've long been of the view, Simon, that Dark Lord tone, you know, the tone that we know and love, wasn't actually born until the second administration, the second Blair ministry. When was that? 2001? Was there an election in that year?
Yes.
I really think that first 97 to 2001 period was basically Blair, like, getting all his bruises, like you said, learning the different ways in which the system is going to, you know, screw him over, learning the ropes, gaining XP, if you want to put it that way, being told what to do by SMADs and so on. And it's really from 2001 onwards that you get the modern Machiavellian Blair, if that makes any sense. Which is something that he even mentions, I think, in both of his books, you know, My Bookie Work, My Journey, My Struggle, and the recent one on leadership. He kind of repeats some of that stuff there as well.
Kind of
interesting. Whereas Gordon Brown, I think, was always a very different type of character. I think Blair is someone who learns on the job. He's experiential.
Yes.
Whereas Brown is extremely bookish, right? He had already studied type thing. His problem is that he couldn't translate all the stuff he had in his head, his theory, into, like, the television screen. Like, he couldn't operate as something. He was in many ways a very old-fashioned politician, Gordon Brown. Someone who would have fit in with the Attlee government or something, you know, where they didn't really do TV interviews or have PR back then, you know. Yes. Anyway, let's carry on.
New Labour turned to the mathematical systems that John Major had brought in, but on a scale never seen before. They believed that people actually behaved in the way described by the simplified economic model. Performance targets and incentives would be set for everything and everyone. Even cabinet ministers would have to fulfil their performance targets or be punished.
300 or so performance targets.
Just, it's that little zoom in on John Prescott, you know, suffering under the targets or whatever. Very courtesy moment. He loves that little zoom in on somebody's face, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Over 150 efficiency targets. Each public service agreement will have a named minister who is responsible for delivering and achieving those targets. They may not have to resign, but they will have to explain why they haven't been able to meet their targets. If a department fails to meet those targets, then it's only right and proper that government will look seriously at their ability to deliver.
The Treasury, under Gordon Brown, created a vast mathematical system. They invented ways of giving numerical values to things that previously no one thought could be measured. Hunger in sub-Saharan Africa was to be reduced to below 48%, while world conflict was to be reduced by 6%. And all the towns and villages in Britain were to be measured for a community vibrancy index.
Oh my God, the community vibrancy index. We know where that leads.
That's fantastic. So just
this village is not vibrant enough.
Just a little bit of context here. So, as I said, a lot of this stuff started in the 80s in local government. Mrs. Thatcher in 1988 initiated something called the creation of the Next Steps agencies and setting in place KPIs, key performance indicators. And they, what the idea was that she was working with a chap called Sir Derek Rayner, and he was her efficiency advisor. And the idea was to hive off about 75% of civil servants, essentially into kind of quangoized agencies. And so they started off with things like Companies House and the Met Office, Intellectual Property Office, the Land Registry. And the aim was to really kind of create sort of like modular elements of government. And this is sort of interestingly charted in, there's a few blogs out there. One is a guy called Professor Colin Talbot, who's a professor of government at Manchester. He's not our guy, but he does some very good value-free analysis. And there's an article on civilserviceworld.com about performance measurement in Whitehall. And the other good chap was Chris Dillon. Oh, sorry, Chris Dillow, I should say. He wrote a book, The End of Politics, New Labour and the Folly of Managerialism. And he's got a very interesting blog called Stumbling Mumbling. And I'll put some links up to these after the stream. But there's certainly been something of a lineage that, you know, Blair, you know, came in and didn't invent this stuff, but they took it and sort of supercharged it.
And even the quality of life in the countryside was broken down into a series of indices, one of which measured how much birdsong there should be.
We want a barometer of the indicators of the quality of life, and they're not simply the economic ones. Half of the skylarks have gone since 1970. Now, if you want to measure the quality of the life, then one of the things is that dawn chorus. It's about indices that affect everybody in a quality of life barometer.
The original idea behind the mathematical system was that it would liberate public servants from old forms of bureaucratic control. Once they were given the targets, they were free to achieve them any way they wanted. But almost immediately, New Labour began to discover that people were more complex and devious than the simple model allowed. Public servants began to find the most ingenious ways of hitting their targets.
It's about the pressure to meet these targets. It's causing some NHS managers to game the system.
Hospital managers proved to be particularly devious. When they were set targets to cut waiting lists they ordered consultants to do the easiest operations first, like bunions and mastectomies. Complicated ones like cancers were no longer prioritised. And they found other clever ways of getting people off the lists.
What happened at this hospital is truly shocking. Administrators wrote to patients asking them when they'd be on holiday. They then used that information to set the timing of the operation, knowing that the patients would be away. As a result, the patients did not get their operations, but the hospital managed to cut its waiting lists.
And when the managers were set a target to reduce waiting times in casualty, they came up with more clever strategies. A new job was invented called the hello nurse, who did nothing to treat the patient, but simply greeting them meant they had been seen and were off the list. When the government then tried to set a target to reduce the number of patients waiting on trolleys, the managers took the wheels off the trolleys and reclassified them as beds.
Can confirm. NHS managers, and I say this from having worked for a period in administration in an NHS teaching hospital in London, they are evil people. And I will say they are nearly all women. Sorry. They take to it like ducks to water, this sort of gerrymandering of performance targets.
This is kind of Soviet level stuff, though, isn't it? This is like, you know, the quotas for the weight of the metal, you know, resulting in the chandeliers falling off the ceilings type stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And they redefined the corridors as walls. And yet again, the patients were off the list. The police were also under pressure to meet their targets. One of the main ones was to reduce the rate of recorded crime. Again, inventive strategies were found. Lothian police announced the most successful crime figures in 25 years. But it was later found that they had reclassified hundreds of crimes, including assault, robbery, and fire raising, as simply suspicious occurrences.
One of my early videos, by the way, is on how Tony Blair cooked the crime stats. I can't remember exactly what it's called now. It's one of the earliest videos in Dark Lord Watch, if you watch it. And I went through how New Labour basically fiddled with crime stats to make it look like all of the crime had gone down. They literally just changed the methodology. I think they changed it from being based on actual crimes to surveys. That was one of the survey estimate they use now.
The figures must be amazing now. I mean, given that we've downgraded things like, you know, murder and paedophilia to somewhat below snarky comments on Facebook, the police's figures must be excellent now.
It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't be included in the figures.
We are passionate about meeting these targets.
Fiddling.
By the management.
Altered their records.
But that's a bit odd. I mean, you're the consultant.
And started to amend some of the answers that the youngsters had given.
Trolley weights, none.
Targets, three levels of targets.
Clear targets, targets, those targets. And focus on those targets. Why are they targets? Targets.
The government tried to dismiss these reports as just a few bad examples. But report after report came out, which revealed that this inventive gaming of the system was now endemic throughout the public services. What was supposed to be a rational system was instead creating a strange world in which no one knew whether to believe the numbers or not. The government's response was to introduce even more mathematical levels of management. Complex systems of auditing were created to monitor workers and make sure they fulfilled the targets in the correct way. What had begun as a system of liberation was turning into a powerful system of control.
I've noticed that Curtis loves the word powerful. He's used it about 100 times in this episode, so we should add it to our Curtis bingo card.
If I don't hit those targets, then I don't get a pay increase. It's as simple as that.
They withhold your increment.
They withhold my increment.
Not meeting the targets is really not an option.
It's such an important target that I get to keep my job this month because there's no red on the screen.
If they don't reach the targets, they're axed, and if they speak out against them, they're axed. We here have a catch-22 situation.
If you get zero-star rated, you are being watched like a hawk.
So, I think you should go.
But the numbers were also having a strange and perverse effect on New Labour's vision of a freer and more open Britain. They were, in fact, creating a more rigid...
See, do you know, I can't help but wonder, Simon, and this is just a kind of me thinking out loud. Do you think targets work in the private sector because they're kind of because of the type of people that end up in the private sector, and that they don't work in the public sector because of the type of people that this is like? It's like,
yeah,
you get bureaucratic types, you get like the sort of person who ends up in these sorts of jobs.
Yes,
is more want to try to find a loophole or a fiddle the books way or a kind of inventive way to meet the target rather than actually trying to like perform. Whereas if you're in a company where you're the bottom line is always the thing, you know, there's just, I don't know.
It's a leader manager thing. I remember an economics guy saying this to me at university about, you know, the difference between leaders and managers, you know, because I was, as I say, I was doing a lot of this theatre stuff and I was directing plays and, you know, I was causing quite a lot of, how can I say, controversial opinion about the way I used to do things. And he said to me one day, he said, Simon, you're the classic example of the difference between leaders and managers. You know, leaders classically are entrepreneurial. They tend to sort of divide people very sharply as to their methods, but they, you know, they're very much, you know, result driven. And he said, I'm more of a manager, and managers are very much more conservative and concerned with process. And so I think that division is what you say is the essentially private public division, that the public sector fosters a lingering mentality over the sort of the repetition, the machinic repetition of process and these sorts of structures. So you get this, in a sense, you develop a kind of managerial autism. You know, a lot of these women I mentioned in the NHS, all they do is spend all day in their office drinking endless cups of tea and doing graphs and charts and really achieving nothing. And you were very conscious that when you tried to achieve an actual palpable goal, a realizable target to fix a problem, there'd be an enormous sort of psychological resistance that would kick in. Because it wasn't about process, it wasn't about observance, it wasn't about compliance with rules. So there's definitely, I think, a public sector mentality, which is essentially a very unimaginative kind of mindset, which can do basic things like tallying things on a spreadsheet, but doesn't have a genuine interest in where that goes, where that ends up, how that affects change.
Yep. I mean, someone in the chat saying that they get paid good or bad. The whole point of this, though, is that Labour tried to introduce financial incentives into that. Like, so if I don't do this, I lose my job, or if I don't hit this target, you know, I don't get a pay rise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But it still didn't work. It still resulted in them just kind of, you know, finding a shortcut or a loophole or a way to fiddle it, not to actually hit the target itself. So,
and it was only a particular niche of the workforce as well. It was only those people in those managerial positions who effectively formed the client state that Labour bought. You know, the proliferation of those kinds of positions since New Labour came to power, you know, meant that you had effectively a ready-made voter base in those people who were somewhat incentivized in, you know, in salaries of, you know, 40K upwards, but everybody else was, you know, still slogging away on the old arrangement.
Stratified society. At the heart of this was education and the league tables for schools. The tables showed parents which were the best performing schools and which were the worst ones. The government said that this would incentivise the less successful ones to compete and improve their services, and standards would then rise across the country. In fact, the very opposite happened. Rich parents moved into the areas of the best schools, which then caused house prices to spiral, keeping the poor out. And nearly all schools taught their pupils only those narrow facts they would need to answer in exams, and so would help the schools rise up the league tables. What was lost was the wider education that would help the poorer children rise up in society. In 2006, a series of reports made it clear that there was a definite link between the government's policies in education and the rise of social segregation based on wealth. This has contributed to a much wider problem: social mobility in Britain, has now ground to a halt.
Pause.
The stark fact is...
Just read a brief extract here from a piece called The Elephant in the Room, Why Gordon Brown and New Labour Got Things So Wrong. This is by a chap called Christopher Nock. And he writes in a sort of online journal of, you know, British current affairs studies called Observatoire de la Société Britannique. It's an interesting article. There's a particular paragraph here that I'm going to read to you. It says, the rise of the regulatory state and the target culture in the UK was a particular response to the demands of globalization and its attendant marketization of society. The state may set goals and targets, but must leave suppliers free to fulfill their contractual obligations as they themselves see fit. Those obligations must be developed in response to the ongoing balancing of stakeholder interests. As such, from the British perspective, globalization demanded a significant reduction in the state's agenda-setting power that had been associated with a now defunct modern industrial epoch. What were required in the global era were strategies for dealing with an uncertain world in a time of great change. Indeed, from the British perspective, change now seemed to represent new certainty. In its leadership role, government should listen and cooperate where possible. In particular, it should listen to those with expertise. This approach seems to have been informed by Tony Blair's own brand of pragmatic opportunism. What counts is what works.
The irony, though, is that none of this stuff works.
No.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
This is the trap. We're still in it.
The children of rich families in Britain today are much more likely to live and die rich than in the recent past, while children from poor families are more likely to live and die poor. The country has become more rigid and stratified than at any time since the Second World War. New Labour had adopted the market model of freedom, believing that there would be a trade-off. They gave up their old political role of intervening in the market to reduce inequality, but what was supposed to follow was a new openness and fluidity in society. In fact, they now have the worst of both worlds. Society has become more rigid, while the inequalities have become more extreme.
Great body
under
language
New Labour,
in that shot.
The country is even more unequal than it was under Mrs. Thatcher, with an ever-increasing share of the wealth going to a tiny 1% at the top of society. And the inequalities not only affect how you live, but also when you will die. Across the country, differences in life expectancy have increased since 1997. And inequalities in child mortality by class have also increased. A baby born in Hackney is now twice as likely to die in its first year as a baby born in Bexley.
Nice one, Diane.
Beneath the meritocratic surface, the social class divisions in Britain are hardening and deepening. In America, throughout the 1990s, the economic model of democracy was leading not just to the rise of inequality, but to financial and political corruption on a huge scale. America had experienced a spectacular market boom, but those running the market had realized that the numbers were not telling the truth, because the giant accounting firms had become corrupted.
There was a new element of...
And this came out before 2008, didn't it, Simon? This documentary, this is 2002.
Let's have a look. The Trap. When is it? I keep getting mixed up with the days. It is 2007. Yeah, it is 2007.
So just before the real financial crisis hit.
Interesting. Interesting fact about this guy. This chap, Levitt, he was a policy advisor at Goldman Sachs and a director of Bloomberg. He was also a senior advisor at the Carlyle Group.
Interesting. That relates to a recent conversation that we had. Speaking, by the way, of global crashes, my video tomorrow features Black Horse, who... pours a bit of cold water on Jason Mirren Chuck's prediction that the global economy will crash next year. But Black Horse, for various reasons, does not believe that this is about to happen. Quite a long video, but one that I hope people will watch with interest.
But the very foundation of the market, the numbers that represented the sanctity of the market, the reliability of the market, were becoming unreliable because the accountants had violated the trust the government had placed in them. I knew that the great accounting firms of America had engaged in practices that were very, very questionable and very often fraudulent. We were seeing more and more and more of these cases.
How widespread did it become?
Extremely widespread.
Those who ran many of America's corporations were faking profits on an enormous scale. They did this because it would then increase their personal bonuses.
Come on, they would say, isn't there another way of looking at those numbers? Can we compromise? Can we spread, for example, this misrepresentation over a number of years? In all of these cases, the effect is one of corruption. We were trusted. We had a rational system based on numbers that could not be disputed. We ended up now with a fictitious, irrational system.
The officials, whose job was to regulate the market, tried to persuade politicians in Congress to act and expose this, but they were blocked at every turn. They found that all the key politicians were being given millions of dollars in campaign contributions by both the corporations and the accounting firms.
I mean, massive amounts of money were spent in...
I mean, this is essentially what happened in 2008, isn't it? Which is that various different toxic debt bundles were given incorrect credit ratings by Standard & Poor's and Fitch and Moody's, the rating agencies, who are not independent, who have basically been bought off. So everybody had this kind of faulty metric, and it led to 2008, which happened, of course, under Blair and Brown's watch.
Mm. And indeed, overvaluation goes back as far as our friends in the Mayfair set, Tiny Rowland and Lonro, and the overpricing of companies there.
Very interesting.
Lobbying committees of Congress. I knew they were motivated by concern for business interests.
You mean they'd been bribed?
No, I wouldn't use that word. That's your word.
What word would you use?
Seduced.
Despite the growing evidence of corruption, the Clinton administration portrayed the boom as something revolutionary. It was a genuine democracy of the marketplace in which everyone at all levels of society was benefiting. But this was completely untrue. If one compares the incomes of Americans in real terms between the end of the 1970s and the end of the 1990s, those at the bottom of society saw their income actually fall. Those in the middle saw a slight increase, while those at the top increased by an extraordinary amount.
If you take income after taxes, you find that the average household cash income in the bottom fifth of Americans went from $9,300 a year to $8,700. You find that the average household cash income in the middle fifth, the median, went from about $31,800 to $33,200. You take the top 1% in the same time period, you go from $256,000 a year to $644,000 a year. That, to me, is the simplest set of numbers I can use to sum it all up. I have many variations, but those just eat right out of the box at you. It's just incredible how you can have something like that.
Was there?
Go on, Simon. Yeah.
Just to say, very interesting guy, Kevin Phillips. I'd say go and look him up. He was a sort of, you know, Republican to the bone when he started out. He was originally thought of as being part of the new right in America, but it was around that time of Nixon. So it's difficult to say which new right he was on, whether it was the sort of Buckleyite new right or whether it was the sort of second iteration, people like Pat Buchanan and Gingrich and Milton Friedman. But he was credited with something called the Southern Strategy, in electoral terms. And I'll just read a brief clip about him, because he had a very interesting interesting history. He said, Kevin Phillips, he told a journalist during the 1968 presidential election that the whole secret of politics is knowing who hates you. Who hates who. After Nixon was elected, Phillips wrote a book on what has come to be known as the Southern strategy of the Republican Party. Entitled The Emerging Republican Majority, it argued that the southern states of the U.S. would keep the Republicans winning presidential elections and more than offset the decline in Republican support in Northeast states based on the racial resentment of white voters. As he stated to the New York Times magazine in 1970, I'm going to sort of use some euphemisms here, all the talk about Republicans making inroads into the African-American vote is persiflage. Even Jake the Snake, liberal Republican Senator Jacob Javits of New York, only gets 20%. From now on, Republicans are never going to get more than 10 to 20% of the African-American vote, and they don't need any more than that. But Republicans would be short-sighted if they weakened the Voting Rights Act. The more African-Americans who register as Democrats in the South, the sooner the whites who don't like African-Americans will quit the Democrats and become Republicans. And that's where the votes are. Without that prodding from the African-Americans, the whites will backslide into their old comfortable arrangement with the local Democrats.
Fascinating. I've always been aware of the Southern strategy. I didn't quite know how sneaky it was that the that the black Democrat vote was actually baked in to deliberately inculcate polarization. Very interesting indeed.
Look him up in your own time, chat. He's a very interesting figure. He started using the term financialization to describe how the U.S. economy moved away, you know, from industrial production to focusing on, you know, speculation and debt and so on. But you know, he became quite a critic of the Republicans later on, as probably many people should be.
Well, one of the things that would be remiss of me not to mention is that his stuff about the categories, his stuff about the, oh, you know, people in this wage bracket and that wage bracket, this is one of Thomas Sowell's bugbears. And I would be remiss not to mention Thomas Sowell's "The Same Person Moves In and Out of These Categories Over Their Life." And they are, you know, basically those categories that he's talking about are meaningless statistical constructs, because you're not talking about actual flesh and blood human beings. So basically every person, or most people, like the median man over the course of his life, will, you know, when he's 18 or 19 or 20 years old, he'll be in that bottom 20% category. By the time he's like in his mid-50s, he'll probably be towards the, you know, towards the middle or the top end of the category. And this is something Thomas Sowell points out time and time and time again. The one thing that Sowell does not account for that he did mention, though, is the increase in the wealth share of the 1%. That, I think, is something that Sowell has no answer for, ultimately, because he thinks it's justified, or because he's apologizing for them or on their side, essentially. Whereas I would say that that is, you know, what actually justifies that top 1 or top 0.1% having more and more of the wealth share. Because I think it's leading to systemic problems. I mean, in the case of California, famously, it's just completely hollowed out the middle. California is literally just like, you know, a Google employee on $250K and then like literally a semi-legal or flat-out illegal migrant who cleans their kitchen on their behalf for like, you know, less than minimum wage, you know, and that is California. So yeah, just worth mentioning those things.
Practical experiments of the 1990s had been a simplified idea of human beings, that at heart they were just self-seeking individuals whose needs could be best met through the marketplace, not politics. If left unregulated, the markets would benefit everyone. In the face of this simple, irresistible argument, politicians had given away much of their power. But what had actually happened was the return of inequalities and social injustices not seen for 100 years. The very thing politicians were supposed to prevent. Politicians now found themselves weakened and corrupted, and without the power to change society. And millions of individuals were left without representation and even less control over their lives.
Here is the ultimate irony, because as people began to believe they are just self-seeking, acquisitive individuals, that the democratic systems are...
I mean, another way of phrasing all of this in hindsight, Simon, is the rise of populism and the likes of Donald Trump and all of our current discontents were just waiting to happen, basically, and that all of the seeds for it were being laid here. Obviously, Curtis wouldn't have known that at this point, but I wonder if Curtis ever takes a step back and looks at his own back catalogue and is like, yeah, Trump was inevitable, basically. I don't know if he does that, though.
And Reich here coming in again as you know, he's our sympathetic kind of, you know, uncle telling us a story round the fire. You know, he's always framed in that way as the sort of soft liberal kind of summing up of probably Curtis's own position.
Are fundamentally not nearly as good as the market for fulfilling whatever it is you want. People allowed elites to take over politics and politics to be distorted and corrupted so that politics became even less capable of fulfilling people's needs.
I mean, as the author of Populist Illusion, Simon, it is absolutely...
We allowed it to happen, didn't we? We allowed them to take over the elites.
People allowed the elite. I mean, what a ridiculous statement. There has never been any time, moment in history, pretty much, where the elites have not been in control. The only question is which elites, really? And I mean, Curtis has done a pretty good job of outlining which elites. It's a kind of set of managerial elites wedded to the bankers. Let's face it, we all know that. And these they're still pretty much in power today. Well, at least they are for the next month or so in America. Fingers crossed.
And meanwhile, the market did not give people good jobs, secure jobs. And so ultimately, the individual cannot be fulfilled either through politics or through the market.
What had given the simplified view of human beings much of its power had been ideas drawn from both mathematics and biology. As this program has shown, it underpinned a powerful model of ourselves as almost computer-like machines, whose instincts had largely been encoded within them millions of years before. But now, questions were beginning to be asked in the scientific world about whether this was too simple a view of human beings. In genetics, the idea that the DNA is the all-controlling set of instructions for life has been replaced by a more complex idea. Scientists have shown that a cell actually chooses and edits which parts of the DNA to use, depending on the environmental forces acting on it. One of the key experiments that showed that the self-interested actions of genes control behavior has also been questioned.
Pause.
Anthropologists looked into the history.
Go on. Yeah.
Just to hit that little bit of Curtis there, this is the field of epigenetics, and we're going to sort of summarize, you know, something about Napoleon Chagnon's work in a minute. But have you ever heard of the Emery mouse experiments with the cherry blossom scent? Do you know about that?
No, I don't. No.
This is an interesting one that, you know, when I, you know, I'd watched The Trap a number of times, and this came up a few years later in 2013. But researchers at Emory University, a fellow called Diaz, did experiments with mice, essentially to look at the genetic inheritability of trauma. And the experiment was pretty much that they would take these sample mice and put them in a cage, and the cage would have an electrified floor. And so that at certain points with the mice living in the cage, they would put a little charge through the floor, and at the same time they would waft in cherry blossom scent to these mice. So they were getting into a state of, you know, high discomfort and agitation, you know, sort of micro trauma. And this was repeated over time. And then what they did was they took sperm from those mice and essentially, you know, IVF'd them into other, you know, non-exposed mice and grew the children, the baby mice of these original, experimental mice mm-hmm. who'd been micro-traumatized and brought them up in a neutral environment. In a cage without an electrified floor. But when they wafted the scent of cherry blossom over these mice, they became very agitated. So the idea was
fucking dark.
So that there was a heritability of the trauma sensitivity to the cherry blossom smell that had been passed on. And they'd obviously done blinds and controls to make sure it wasn't just through a sort of socialization memory, but that it was an idea that the genetic, at the DNA level in the original mice, the microtrauma had sort of rewritten part of the DNA coding and passed that on. It's not necessarily that it passes on for more than two or three generations, so far as we know at the moment, because it's a relatively new area. I mean, this is the sort of, you know, where you want Ed Dutton on hand to sort of talk about stuff like this. But it's very interesting. A lot of it was then used to theorize about the relations of historic trauma. I mean, in particular, there was interest in the Dutch famine at the end of World War II and about how that reflected in subsequent generations of Dutch children, where there were the interesting phenomena like distortions of weight gain in those children as a result of what had happened. But this sort of very much feeds into this idea of you know, the DNA is edited as you go on in life, and your experiences in a sense become embedded and can be passed on. So
have they tried to replicate this with other groups, like, for example, I don't know, wafting Zyklon B through certain parts of New York?
No comment.
Measuring to see how many traumatic.
It obviously has been theorized as applicable to sort of, you know, great historical traumas as well. But there's limited sort of response in terms of human studies. You know, people say, well, it's early days, we don't know. But it's you know, it's interesting that the mice are sort of.
I seem to remember that about 10 years ago there was quite a bit on like inherited trauma. For specifically like European Jews, for example, as a kind of blood memory, if that makes any sense. And I wonder if it grew in any of this stuff. Okay. I'm trying to remember the name of some of the books now. You know, my wife is a big believer in what she calls inherited memory. That, you know, very interesting thing to think about.
Certainly emotional sensitivity to things, and you could possibly see there'll be human studies in sort of areas where there are, you know, clusters of people predisposed to alcoholism or you know, things like that in families, where there are certain sort of key stimuli which, you know, may not be shared by all the members of the family, but then, you know, these genetic sensitivities are passed on in some way.
Well, one question I've got is, are mice, like, under normal circumstances, do mice like cherry blossom, or do they dislike? That's another question. I think it was
selected as something sort of more or less unfamiliar to mice, you know, and they did a control group with using some sort of neutral alcohol as well, which didn't produce any sort of inherited traumatic effect, but the cherry blossom one certainly did.
Extremely dark.
Of the Yanomamo tribes, and discovered a pattern to their violence that could be explained by very different causes than genes. It only seemed to happen when the Yanomamo came into contact with Westerners who gave them goods. The tribes fought with each other for access to those goods.
What I discovered was that there was a pattern in which the warfare became more intense or happened at all during times of greater Western penetration into the area. You're not going to get any help by looking at their reproductive striving. I think what will explain that for you is what is the historical interactions with these powerful outside forces. That explains when and where they fight.
And those powerful outside forces are what?
The powerful outside forces are predominantly the Westerners who come in, who are sources of these much-desired goods.
Anthropologists have looked again at the film of the axe fight. They argue that what one actually sees is a struggle between two factions. One, a group who have been given machetes by the filmmaker, Napoleon Chagnon. The other, a group of visitors to the village who are refusing to leave because they too want access to these precious gifts. The real cause of the fight, they say, is not the genes, but a struggle of politics and power aggravated by the filmmaker himself.
Yeah.
Sounds plausible, to be honest. It really does sound plausible to me.
But. Well, this is the thing, isn't it? This is the sort of classic nature versus nurture debate, really, taking place in academia. And what I feel now from looking a bit more at this case is that Chagnon is being framed here, as we're going to see, as the guy who was just wrong. And you've got that chap Ferguson there. Now he's someone whose lineage is, you know, Columbia University, Rutgers. I think these are sort of well-known kind of liberal, very liberal universities. And he's known for attacking evolutionary psychology from a sociological kind of critique point of view. And what you find with Chagnon is that, you know, one of those sort of damning words that's used when you want to smear someone in the public gaze is controversial. And this is the word that comes up with Chagnon. You know, it may be that his work is right, but he's controversial. So it sort of plants that seed of doubt. And there was an array of anthropologists and ethnographers who came out against Chagnon to dismiss the idea that there was, in this context, a question about, if you like, the dominance of certain men in the Yanomamo tribe was to do with their capacity for violence, and therefore that enhanced their reproductive ability. You know, this is kind of Ed Dutton's fast life strategy. You know, these were the guys who were the physically ferocious dominant alpha males, and they got the birds, and they reproduced more successfully. So a sort of straight sort of Darwinian evolutionary view. And of course, all the critics that have come out are all of the kind of socio-cultural materialist point of view, essentially criticizing Chagnon for taking this gene heritability based approach. There was a notable chap called Marshall Salins, who was one of Chagnon's graduate teachers. He criticized his methods with this criticism that Curtis is relating about, Chagnon bringing sort of various gifts, machetes, guns, things like that. Now, it turns out when you look a bit more broadly, other anthropologists do admit and say, well, actually, this is part of kind of what we do when we go into these places, is we do give them gifts in exchange for insights and access and information. So in a sense, Chagnon is not doing something necessarily out of the ordinary, but he may have been one of the first in the modern era to be doing this. You have people like Marshall Salins, as I say, this particular critic who stormed out of the National Academy of Sciences because he wanted to protest against Chagnon being part of that body as well. And there were some allegations, for instance, that Chagnon and his colleague, this chap Neil, had come along and they'd introduced a vaccination for measles at one point. And this was framed as a sort of cynical experiment to test, to look at mortality in exposure to the measles vaccine. And there was allegations that the measles vaccine they brought in was very dangerous and so on. And when giving it to people who, you know, living in these off-grid tribes who are very often immunocompromised from the point of view of sort of, you know, Western industrial era diseases, that this was very dangerous. And they were given a vaccine and nearly a fifth of them died because of this. But the allegation was that somehow the vaccine had caused the outbreak of the measles. And later this was repudiated, you know, by the official body and said, well, no. And even the manufacturers of the vaccine themselves say, well, you can't create an outbreak of measles by giving them the vaccine like this. But that was a thing that was held against Chagnon by this guy Salins. And so, you know, Chagnon himself, you know, was aware of this, that he was getting kind of criticized from the point of view of this sort of postmodern ideology, which was essentially scientific, you know, in its own interest, insofar as it explained things through cultural and material circumstances, nurture, rather than the genetic mapping that he was doing, which was very much more perhaps in keeping with how we're looking at things now.
You know, this Marshall Sahlins was quite influential on the new historicist critics in Shakespeare studies, believe it or not. He was one of the key, like Clifford Geertz was another one, but Marshall Sahlins, like he, for some reason, all of these California Shakespeare critics like Stephen Greenblatt and various others were into Marshall Sahlins. So through this, I have actually read the work of Marshall Sahlins. He's got one book called Islands of History. That's it. And one of the things that Sahlins does in that book is that he does like a deep dive on Captain Cook and the impact of what happened when Captain Cook went to the various islands that he went to. Was it the Easter Islands he went to? The Cook Islands, obviously, right? So obviously, famously, the people of the Cook Islands worshipped Captain Cook and his men almost as a god, right? They thought that this guy was incredible. But anyway, one of the little deep insights that you get from Sahlins, not that he is trying to get to this insight, it's one of those kind of moments where somebody's accidentally based, right? Is he says, well, basically, it didn't take long for every single woman on the Cook Islands to cuckold their husbands to sleep with Captain Cook's men because they were, it was a hypergamous scenario, right? So you had, and in fact, such was the reverence that all of the people on this island had for Cook and his men, the guys and the kind of hierarchy of the tribe there, they were kind of all right with this. So they had this weird moment of almost like institutionalized cuckolding. It's really, really bizarre and interesting scenario.
That sort of intersects with other stuff as well that's come out. I mean, I've had a good friend of the channel send me some interesting material on this whole controversy about Chagnon's work. And there's an interesting aspect here. There was a French anthropologist called Jacques Lizot, and he went and lived amongst the Yanomami, and he was very critical of Chagnon. But one thing that's written about Lizot was he probably distributed more clothes and shotguns than any other individual amongst the Yanomami. And he took advantage of that trade to sleep with the young boys in the tribe. So there's a little paragraph here. It says whatever homosexual practices the Yanomami had prior to Lizzo's arrival, shotgun-driven prostitution is nothing to brag about in their culture. So there was certainly the kind of underbelly of personally compromised figures who were prepared to criticize Chagnon, while at the same time, if you like, exploiting and taking advantage far more than he ever did. And so I think there is this case to make that he has been quite traduced in the public mind, and it's probably worth going away to look at, let's say, a more revisionist history of Chagnon to get at what many people think is a very great and honest anthropologist.
Very interesting. I mean, I'm also reminded of the recent sex scandals with Oxfam, you know, where people go over to these poor places in Africa under the guise of doing charitable works or whatever, and then they end up kind of just taking advantage of the power, of the difference in the power relation, and they become predatory, you know, in a sexual way. There is also a parallel. I've got a video, very old video, called "The Economics of Foreign Aid," where I look at how the local NGO or the local charity worker completely distorts the local economy. Because let's say, I don't know, you're working for $1 a day in a mine in, I don't know, Senegal or something, right? Or Congo, let's say. You rock up, you're paying the driver $100 a day, right? And the and these guys are, you know, may not earn $100 in a year. So when they go there, they completely distort the local economy to the extent where the local doctor would rather be the driver for the charity person. Well, of course, if the doctor is acting as a driver for this rich kid who's come to, you know, do good works or whatever, that means the town hasn't got a doctor.
Yeah.
And there are all sorts of other weird things that happen where, you know, they bid up the price of goods and water to the extent where all of the people put their prices up to try to get the you know, the crew of whites that have gone there, you know, to save them. And it means the locals are then priced out or they have to go to the black market or whatever. It's a remarkable effect that, that happened with that. But it kind of reminds me of this situation here where, you know, whether it's this guy taking sexual advantage of them or indeed the introduction of the machetes into the...
It's all kind of subsequent, in a sense, to the classic boomer, what I call Star Trek morality. You know, the sort of principle in Star Trek, you know, we go visit these other planets, but we have a strict non-interference principle in their culture. You know, so in a sense, everything that you can then parse about that cultural interaction comes out of this materialist analysis. And the thing that was said about Chagnon, it says others questioned the ethics inherent in painting an ethnic group as violent savages, pointing out that Chagnon's description of the Yanomamo as such breaks with anthropology's traditional ethics of trying to describe foreign societies sympathetically, and argued that his depictions resulted in increased hostility and racism against the Yanomamo by settlers and colonists in the area. Well, again, that's hardly a scientific approach to say that our principle is going to be to describe people sympathetically, that we describe them as they are. Again, it's your value-free judgment.
Yeah, and exactly, yes.
That's what the case is here. It's quite a, you know, profound struggle in academic terms.
I've always been kind of interested in this bit of anthropology, but like I say, because they were really influential on the new historicists who I studied with some kind of intensity, you know, my PhD, etc. Was essentially on the new historicists and the cultural materialists, and they use these anthropologists basically as a kind of model through which they would then approach the past, right? So if you can imagine the anthropologist encountering this tribe is the same as us encountering Shakespeare. You see the move they make, okay?
Yeah.
Now, the thing is that the Clifford Gates types, they're always trying to get to, the way he describes it is, imagine you're an alien, okay, coming down to Earth, and you see like a normal school, like a school here, okay? And you see a cheeky schoolboy give a wink, right? About to play a trick, let's say, and he gives a little cheeky schoolboy wink. Winker Watson, you know, little schoolboy wink. Well, he says, if you're truly an alien, you don't really know the ways of human beings. You would write that down as, oh, there was a strange muscle spasm in the eye of one of the children. Okay, and what Gates said is that the anthropologist's job is to study a group long enough that the alien comes to know that the cheeky schoolboy wink means that the schoolboy is about to play a trick, right? Now, there's so much context, there's so much you have to learn about human beings from the alien's point of view to get to that point, okay? Now the problem is, the thing that I, and this has brought it up in a really interesting way, okay, so this dude that we're talking about is introduced to machete there, okay? But even if you don't introduce the machete, right, even if you're just Clifford Gates going there as the alien with the notebook, does the very fact that you've gone there in and of itself change something about what's happening? Could the tribe be showing off, for example? Could they be lying to you, as we saw earlier on in this documentary? you know, could they change their ways to welcome a guest, for example, i.e. they're on their best behavior versus, and all of these questions are never really asked in the work. So I'm fascinated by the extent to which the truly value neutral perspective can be reached when you're dealing with a real group like this. I mean, really, you'd have to be invisible.
And Chanyeol was aware of coming in to this situation and having to, you know, he was at real physical threat at points. There were sort of factions within the tribes that were aware that, you know, he would give them gifts, and so they would modulate their behavior for the gifts. But at the same time, they would also warn him about other factions who were trying to kill him. And he describes in one interview I saw about he would have to go to sleep with a torch in his hand, because guys would try to sneak up and sort of bash his head in with axes, but they were frightened of the torch, you know. So when he switched it on, he had to sort of do little demonstrations of power. He describes one thing where he got a water bottle and he threw it in the air and he blasted it with his shotgun to illustrate the sort of, you know, the power of the shotgun. And that sort of, you know, cast him in a light, a sort of almost like godlike kind of power that made him, you know, both a sort of someone that they were trying to cultivate, but also a target and a threat. So he was kind of aware that you can't go in with this completely neutral interaction, but at the same time, you can sort of, you know, try to negotiate things from the point of view of what you understand about the basic power relations between people. And it's going to be messy. It's not going to be a clean kind of, you know, the old, you know, the anthropologists are sort of, he said, you know, they were thinking in terms of the noble savage. This is the idea, the sort of romanticized version of people who are kind of living in harmony with nature and uncorrupted and sweet and kind. But as you said, as we saw last week, you know, they were just as ready to take the piss out of him when they came along, just like we would. You know? So in a sense, there is no difference.
Yeah. I mean, just before we finish out, I mean, I've often struggled with, you know, my attempt to have the value-free gaze. It's like, well, even if I achieve that, the fact that I have a channel with 100,000 people who watch it, and the fact that reasonably important people sometimes watch this channel or read my stuff, etc., does that actually have a distortive effect? Like, the very fact that I'm saying these things, writing these articles, is that actually having an effect on what's happening? In one way or the other, right? I mean, this is something else I worry about, is that the very point of making the observation then has an effect in and of itself. I don't know what to do about that. It's kind of
the point of what we're doing here. We're saying to people, as we keep saying, you know, we're taking Curtis, but we're not always taking him at his word, and we are, you know, opening it up to be questioned, and that is kind of the ongoing intellectual process. You know, you're gonna have to do your own thinking, guys, but you know, there are things where, you know, we can just peel back a little bit of Curtis's narrative and find, well, it's not quite as straightforward as you think.
I mean, can you imagine that Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy have secretly been spying on the bet between me and Aaron McIntyre on putting the woke away, right? And they've made a higher level. Do you remember that Trading Places?
yeah.
Right? That actual elites have made a higher level bet as to, like, and they're going to, like, you know, diddle the outcome one way or the other as a kind of their own kind of dark exercise. I don't know.
McIntyre is sweating. It's not just the Florida heat.
All right, let's wrap this up.
But Chanyeol completely disagrees and stands by his experiment.
No, I don't think the axe fight happened because I was there.
You sure?
Well, are you sure your father's your father? I think it would be a reasonable presumption that this axe fight would have happened whether or not I was there. And the very fact that I was there and documented it was not the cause of it. Because axe fights or club fights happen in many other villages when I'm not there. And I've documented these as well through informants who described them. So I don't think this particular fight was anything extraordinary and out of the pattern of Yanomama violence.
You don't think a film crew in the middle of a fight in a village has an effect?
No, I don't. That's the end of my interview.
Yeah. But it leaves a bad impression with the viewer, doesn't it? That's what came away. That's what a lot of people came away with, assuming that, you know, well, he must be a wrong one, you know, he's rage quit the interview. But I think he's probably pissed off.
Do you think that the presence of Adam Curtis and his camera there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Schrodinger's Curtis, you know. Yeah.
And in mathematics, the man who had created the equations that lay behind the simplified economic model of society was also expressing doubts about the assumptions on which his work had been based. He was the mathematician John Nash. Nash, who has now recovered from paranoid schizophrenia and still works at Princeton, has come to believe that the purely rational, calculating creatures in his model, what he calls the human as businessman, have little connection with the complexity of real human beings.
I have had some trouble myself on the psychological level. I've been in mental hospitals, and so I have, I may be developing a pattern of rationality. I realize that what I had said at some time may have overemphasized rationality or some type of thinking, and I don't want to overemphasize rational thinking on the part of humans. Human beings are much more complicated than like the human being at business, as a businessman. Human behavior is not entirely motivated by self-interest of each pure human.
But the underlying assumption of game theory is that it is.
Game theory works in terms of self-interest. But it was like the viewpoint that some game theory concepts could be unsound. There's overdependence on rationality. That is my enlightenment.
And Nash is not alone. In economics, the whole idea that the free market is an efficient system is coming under serious attack. Over the past 5 years, many of the Nobel Prizes for economics have been awarded for research that shows that markets do not create stability or order. That what Adam Smith called the invisible hand is invisible because it isn't actually there.
Do you know, it's a little bit unfair to Adam Smith, because Adam Smith wrote another book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments.
I did wonder about this,
Where, bless him, Adam Smith basically came to all those conclusions that Nash just talked about hundreds of years ago, as did David Hume and all of the others. At that time, they were well aware that human beings were not non-rational, non-logical, as you know, being Pareto later and Kahneman and Haidt, as I've talked about. But Adam Smith got there first, I would argue, in that book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments.
They may be irrational, but it doesn't mean to say they're not self-interested, and that's something to bear in mind. You know, they still may be exercising the low cunning, you know, to acquire their desires. But as you said, you know, they form their, if you like, their outward political view or their explanation of the world post hoc rather than in line with.
Yeah, exactly. It comes, the reasoning comes second, basically. And I mean, this is a kind of where you can get people acting in non-rational, self-interested ways, which is kind of a little bit complicated. But I don't want to get into it, all of it, like right now. But it's like, even like I'll give you an example, right? Just Justin Trudeau, say, who's just announced the biggest cut in immigration for 100 years, okay, if for Canada. Did Justin Trudeau want to do that? Was he ideologically driven? Is he self-interested? You know, there's a whole confluence of factors that have gone to him announcing that. Okay. Was he ever rational in the first place? Like, were any of the decisions that led up to that point rational from a kind of value neutral point of view? No. But from Justin Trudeau's weird kind of political career point of view, you can kind of see a sense there. even if his own modes of thought were non-rational at every stage of the way, if that makes any sense. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
All right, let's carry on.
And politicians do have a powerful role to play in controlling the markets. And a new discipline called behavioural economics has been studying whether people really do behave as the...
That's Kahneman, by the way. Behavioural economics is Kahneman. And trying to remember the name of his partner now.
Is that the Freakonomics guys as well?
No.
That's later on.
No, it was Kahneman and... Is it Amos? Kahneman had a buddy who he did all his work with. Then he died. His friend died. And he wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, which was like a greatest hits of all their work. But of course, because his friend has died, only Kahneman's book name is on the front of the book. So Kahneman's the one everybody's heard of. But his buddy, Tversky, that's it. Amos Tversky, that was it. I think that he also won a Nobel Prize at the same time as Kahneman. It just so happens that he died before Kahneman hit international fame.
Simplified model says they do. Their studies show that only two groups in society actually behave in a rational, self-interested way in all experimental situations. One is economists themselves. The other is psychopaths.
Is that all there is? Is that all?
Oh, excellent. All right. Well, it took us a very long time to get through the trap part two, Simon, but
thanks. Yeah, thanks to everyone for bearing with us. It's slightly unusual to go back and do a second half, but hopefully the next time we'll be doing a straight run. Quite an interesting next episode, as you said, about Isaiah Berlin, positive negative liberty, and how Blair came to rationalize that in government.
You know, he mentioned the punchline of the whole thing is only economists and psychopaths thinking this.
Yeah, way. Yeah.
Can't help but think about Keir Starmer, right?
Yeah.
Seems like a total psycho.
Yeah.
They've just announced that inflation is up.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's been liquidating the kulaks, freezing the pensioners, declaring war on the pubs, siding with the murderers against the entire population. And now, just today, he is openly risking nuclear war with Russia, right? I mean, he's literally, there's a journalist asking him, look, shouldn't people be worried that Putin has said that he's going to attack us with nuclear weapons? We must remain steadfast in our commitment to Ukraine. And I just wonder, does Keir Starmer buck the trend? Because none of his actions can be explained even through the lens of self-interest. This is a man with an appetite for destruction. I can't make any sense of any of his actions.
I think that's just you observing what's going on and changing the nature of what reality is.
Well, what is Starmer's self-interest? What is we call him a psycho, but I don't really understand. He's obviously not getting popularity out of it. He is probably the least popular prime minister in our lifetime. He's pissing off every segment of society. He's putting us in danger. He's making us objectively worse off. What's he getting out of this?
Who hurt him? I could go into a long disquisition about a transactional analysis and, that he's getting a psychological payoff from doing all of this, but we can save it for next time.
80 stares blankly, tick. Nick, there are a couple of super chats here before we get out of here. Port Film Co-op says, to all film buffs, the Decameron Film Festival hosted by Frody Midyord starts today. It's a month of based film reviews with people like Devon Stack, Mark Collette on the Guide to Culture Odyssey channel. Yeah, I've done Decameron in previous years. With my new schedule, I can't really make the big events anymore like Decameron. And I've even said that to Woes for Millennials. I'm basically available in the daytime and all of these things happen in the night, right? So, and when people are planning big things like that, they can't really do too many exceptions. Otherwise, you can't make a schedule. They have to say, right, it's 8 p.m. on this day. Otherwise, the whole thing doesn't work. I don't know if you've ever tried to plan anything big like that, Simon, but if you let start letting people pick their own spots, you'll have chaos. you have to say, no, this is your time. Can you make it? You know, and I speak from a background as an events producer in a former life. I'm not going to be making the Cameron this year, and probably not Millennial either. But it is always good, especially if you want to break from politics. And some of the reviews can be quite profound. They can be quite kind of thought provoking. So I'll be tuning into that, and to Yule as ever this year. Hope to see many friends there too. I was about to sign off, but there's more super chats. Hego says, AA, a book recommendation, Our Crowd by Stephen Birmingham. Okay, I will note that. Redacted says, hey, AA, on your last video, you said not to join in parties or groups. There is a value in value-free analysis, but I think you should still have values you work towards with allies. The atom has no power. I would like to correct you there. I did not say don't join parties or groups. If you're talking about the video that went out this morning, what I said is I hate it when everybody in society joins a fad or a craze, like do the shimmy. And I find it inherently cringe. I hate that moment where, oh, everybody do the shimmy. What was that thing with the Gangnam Style? I fucking hate that shit, Simon. You know, when everybody does it.
Yeah, but you just don't understand fads, AA.
I just fucking despise that sort of thing. Or is he talking about when I said don't join formal groups or formal political parties? What I meant there was, to be blunt, redacted, if you join a formal organization, you will have trouble with FEDS. That is what they are drawn towards, like moths to a flame. So you can do that if you'd like, but you're also kind of asking for trouble as well, because that is what the system looks for. And I mean, I'm not sure if like Lenin and the Bolsheviks ever formally said, here's a club, here's your card, you are a member of the Bolsheviks, or if they were just a group of mates who did stuff. I don't know. You'd have to look into that. But having a formal organization like that is asking for trouble in the present moment, especially here in Britain, where, I mean, let's face it, it's basically a Kafkaesque totalitarian state at this point. I hope you're listening, MI5. We're talking about you, guy listening to this stream. Anyway, hope you can sleep safely tonight. What's that film, The Other People's Lives, with the guy?
Lives of Others.
Yeah, The Lives of Others, yeah.
Yes.
You can imagine Starmer doing that role, can't you? You know.
It is virtually the same guy, isn't it? Yeah, kind of dead-eyed.
Retina says, good afternoon, Mr. Simon Roberts and AA. Hope your day has been productive so far. Good to see the return of Adam Curtis on The Deepest Law. It was a very cold day today. It was one of those days where all the cars were covered in frost. AAA loved it. She loves snow. The cold. She loves...
Got an inch of snow here.
Oh, it's snowing there. Oh, right.
It snowed, the other day, Still hanging around.
Well, are you a bit further north then? Where are you?
Midlands region, yeah.
Midlands. Oh, right, okay. Yeah, the north, as I call it. Yeah. Chris Primer says the Federal Reserve runs open mouth operations by taking down the market and managing expectations. That's basically all they do. It's mandatory to work in California prisons. Did you see that? California had a vote called like, I don't know, stop slavery. What they're talking about is hard labor in prison. And overwhelmingly, the Stop Slavery Act failed. What was remarkable about it is that nobody ran. Like there was a campaign to stop slavery, quote unquote, which is basically hard labor in prison. And nobody ran on the opposite end, yet the opposite end still won. It was like 60-40 or something ridiculous like that. remarkable. Dollface says, Christmas ad stream when? Well, we'll see about that. We'll see about Christmas ad stream. I mean, it's November at the minute, so I'm not really feeling it yet. But
it's very, very fatherly answer. It's a good answer there. We will see about that. You know, no promises. Yeah. Keep them state of tension. Yeah,
exactly. All right. Well, Simon, where can people find you, sir?
I'm on Twitter still at Simon_Roberts. Thank you very much for listening today. Look forward to joining you again next week.
And yeah, do buy courses at the Academic Agency. Promo code MERIT, 25% off all courses. And somebody was asking in the chat earlier, you know, if you buy those, do you have them for a limited time? You actually have them for life. It's just a one-off fee. And the reason I've done that is that I hate, Simon, subscription as a service product. It is absolutely cancerous. They do it in so many sneaky ways. I used to have a video editor, right, which I quite liked using, called VideoPad, right? Mm. In fact, that was the video editor on my laptop that has been fucking lost by Currys, right? I bought that outright as a one-off, okay?
Yeah.
I tried to download and install it last night because I'm on this laptop, I use something called Vegas Pro, which is actually a pretty professional piece of kit, but it's really fiddly. And its fiddliness leads me to making errors, right? Because it's just a little bit too good. You know when something is a bit too good? It's too detailed. It's for like an artist or something.
Yeah.
And I want like the dumbed down software like VideoPad for the sort of videos I make most of the time. Well, I went to register it and it was like, oh, sorry, this version is outdated. Yeah. You have to upgrade it. You go to upgrade. Oh, now it's only available on a month-to-month subscription basis. Oh, fucking brilliant. So no sale, VideoPad, until you offer that product as a one-off purchase. I fucking hate subscription as a service.
I've still got Windows Movie Maker. It's the only one I can use. And I've still got Photoshop from 20 years ago, so I don't get it hooked into any kind of subscription software. I hate that myself. It's like those people who buy those vehicles that, you know, the heated seating. You know, you have to pay for a subscription just to be comfortable. You know,
I mean, that's what they want to do. These people, though, they want to make everything that toaster as a service, kettle as a service. You know, I mean, it'll be your entire life. You will own nothing. Anyway, see you tomorrow, everyone. My video tomorrow morning is the one with BlackRock about the global crash. And I was actually thinking that on Friday this week, I might do something a little bit different in my culture slot. What is the stuff you need if you want to make a YouTube video? What are the 5 or 10 programs or bit of kit that you need? Because there's all sorts of little hidden ones that people wouldn't know. And when I see people just start up, they always have little problems, like their sound is too quiet or whatever. And I think that little like 10 tips or tricks after, because I've been making videos for almost a decade now, so I feel like I mean I'm still shit at making videos, as everybody knows, but I'm very wedded to my lo-fi style, but there's still a lot of things you can do. Like there's a little program called CN Levelator. Have you heard of that?
No.
CN Levelator. So all my audio I do in Audacity. You save it as a wave, you stick the wave file on CN Levelator, and it levels out all your audio automatically. I've been using that program for years, going back to my podcast wrestling days. With that one simple trick, you'll make you sound like 100% better than it is. Anyway, bye everybody.
Ciao.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.